Well, tonight we begin the climax, really, the last three sections of Matthew, and he's been building up to this. It's quite appropriate, I think, to see the gospel as an introduction to the passion. It's almost like, well, not, I think it's correct to say that everything up till this point has been to open our minds and our hearts so that we can begin now to look with faith and insight at the central mystery of Jesus' life, namely his death and resurrection. There are many parallels, which you'll just have to take my word for at the moment, I don't intend proving it, but there are many parallels in vocabulary and theme between what we're going to do tonight and what we did last week on the difficult, complex, quite strange material, perhaps to us, called the eschatological discourse. And what these parallels in vocabulary and theme point up, and actually tonight, last week, becomes clear, I think, that for Matthew, the presence of the Son of Man, the coming of the Son of Man, the revelation of the Son of Man, which you remember last week was all about, actually happens in the dying and rising of Jesus. That's the last day, if you want to put a word on it. That's when we see the Son of Man revealed. All you who are standing here will see this. It will all happen in this generation, said Jesus. So this is really the explanation of that mysterious material we saw last week. The Son of Man, who identifies with the oppressed and who is vindicated by the judgment of God, is, and we've been waiting for this right from chapter 8, is the crucified and risen Jesus. He is the one coming to us. He is the one we are invited to see. So Matthew, first of all, and we'll do it in this first session tonight, presents us with Jesus' own understanding of the significance of his death. Because that's the key understanding. As we watch Jesus being murdered, of course, there's little he can say, and he appears to be, as people being murdered always are, victims of other people's decisions. So we could simply look at Jesus as a victim of the oppression, misjudgment, political weakness of the people that decided on his death. But if we only saw that, we wouldn't see what was really happening. To do that, we have to go into the heart of Jesus and see, well, did he see himself as a victim? I mean, he was a victim, but did he see himself that way? Well, tonight you'll see clearly he didn't. We're going to get into how did he understand Friday, Good Friday? Well, the last time he had to tell us that was at the supper, and that's what we'll look at in a moment. And then Matthew, having seen the supper and taken us to the centre of Jesus' own understanding of the mystery of his life, he'll take us through step by step, very simply, very dramatically, and we'll do this next week, the drama of that terrible day, until a Roman soldier and a crowd of people standing round, seeing what actually happened, come to faith. Indeed, this is the Son of God. What they saw all the surface stuff, but they saw him, and that brought them to that faith, as many since have come to it. So we're opening our text at chapter 26, verse 1. A little trivial to start this way, but I won't stay long on it. I'm just going to read you the first verse, and it is, when Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, and then we go on to prepare for the Passover. But I just thought it's handy for you to see every now and then that when we're arranging Matthew's gospel, it's not just an arbitrary thing, it's literary criticism. And you need, of course, I have to learn from the experts, but I can learn from them and then I can teach you. You need to look at the text very carefully, and I've just put there for you four earlier verses from Matthew's gospel, each of them immediately after one of the sermons or discourses of Jesus. There are five in Matthew's gospel following the Pentateuch, the five great books of the old Torah. So he's arranged his gospel in five blocks of teaching, followed by narrative stories that shed light on the teaching and are in turn enlightened by the teaching. But just to show you how a literary critic would go, I'll read them one after the other. Straight after the Sermon on the Mount we read, and as you look at it, look at the first verse of tonight's text. That's the point of this. I'll go through the first verse of tonight's text again, chapter 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples. Matthew 7:28, after the Sermon on the Mount, reads, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowd, and on it goes. Chapter 11, verse 1, the first verse after the second discourse, which is the missionary discourse, reads, when Jesus had finished instructing his 12 disciples, comma, he went on, and then it goes on. Chapter 13, verse 53, immediately after the third group of sayings, which is the parables, says, when Jesus had finished these parables, he left that place. And chapter 19, verse 1, which is immediately after the discourse on the church, the community discourse, we read, when Jesus had finished saying these things, comma, he left Galilee. You can see, can't you, that if you're looking, the gospel wasn't read by most people because they couldn't read. It had to be heard. And so there will be regularly rhythms of speech and memorable repetitions that let people know where they are in the listening process. Otherwise we get a bit lost. So here tonight, if we needed the proof, we've just finished the fifth discourse. And so according to the pattern of the gospel, Matthew begins the saying with a similar thing. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples. What did he say? You know, he said, that after 2 days, the Passover is coming. What's after 2 days mean? Are we meant to simply take it after 2 days, or is there an echo there? I just suggested to you, it's a literary point, I wouldn't want to prove it. Jesus often said things that were going to happen, didn't he? On the third day. On the third day. On that day when God reveals who God is. Well, after 2 days is the third day. Is this the revelation of God that's happening at the new Passover? The whole movement of the feast, of course, from supper to resurrection. And the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified. Then the chief priests and the elders of the people gathered in the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and they conspired to arrest Jesus by stealth and kill him. But they said, not during the festival, or there may be a riot among the people. A delightful irony and humour in the author there, because they've got it all under control, but actually it did happen during the festival. So there we're preparing for our journey. I'll take time now to talk about the Passover. After 2 days, the Passover is coming. I think you're all familiar with this, but I'll just pretend you're not, and just fill you in a little bit so that you get the feel of the Passover feast. We know what it's like to prepare for Christmas. We know what it's like now to prepare for Easter, because it's been in our blood since we were kids. It's all part of our celebration life. Well, the Passover had a definite feeling, a definite expectation, a definite theme, and it's quite fitting that it was the Passover that is reinterpreted by Jesus at the Last Supper. So let's look at the Passover text. We're going to read from the book of Exodus, chapter 12, verse 1 to 14, but it's very important, may I repeat this to you, that when you read the Old Testament text, don't think you're reading a history book. It's about history, it's about events, it's about real people for the most part. Some of it's legendary and some of it's myth and all that, of course. But basically, it's about reality. But reality can be expressed historically, as we like to do it, or it can be expressed dramatically, poetically, liturgically, artistically, stained glass windows, music. I mean, there's a million ways of expressing reality, not just a factual record. Well, this is clearly a liturgical text. It's like the text we use here at Mass or on Holy Saturday night. It's reliving the moment with an assembly who are involved in a liturgy. So that's what we're about to read now. Recalling the past, renewing the past, reimagining the past and reliving it. So Exodus reads, written centuries and centuries after the event. And really it's the rubrics for a ritual. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, each man must take a lamb for his family. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect. Pause. That's an ancient feast, well before Israel. It's a nomadic feast, as you can tell, sheep. People on the move, going for pasture in the spring and back again in winter and all of that nomadic movement with the herds. Well, on the full moon, the spring equinox, when the moon was at its high, well, full moon, they would have this ancient celebration and they would take the best lamb from last year. That's why it's a year old, obviously, from the last lot of lambs we had. And they would offer their best lamb to the gods. And in slaying the animal, this is fairly primitive but fairly common in cultures, they had to kill the lamb to get the blood. The blood's the key thing. Blood is life. Well, they couldn't give their own blood, though some primitive tribes would be so outrageous as to do that. These people didn't do that, but they gave their best possession, their best lamb to God or to the gods in the hope that with that sacrifice the gods would look kindly on them and that this spring there'd be a lovely crop of lambs in the flock. So that's the ancient feast. But feasts can take on a historical meaning and a historical reference. I'll give you an example from our own. There's a really, really, really ancient feast in the Northern Hemisphere at the middle of winter, as you'd expect. The coldest, shortest, darkest day of the year, December the 25th. It used to be. It's drifted. It's now 21st, 22nd. But that was how they interpreted it, and they saw that as the winter solstice in the north. And they had this, just as the sun turned around and started to come back, they had this wonderful celebration to the sun so that it would come back. Part of the natural rhythm. Well, isn't it fitting that when Christianity came, we took that ancient pagan human feast and gave it a Christian meaning? And so Jesus is born on the 25th of December. It doesn't work in Australia, but it does work in Europe. Jesus is born at the darkest, shortest, coldest day of the year, as it were. And as soon as he's born, every day there's more and more light. So an old natural feast is now gilded and shaped by the person of Jesus so that all the ancient festivals continue, but now with a new meaning. Well, that's what they did here. They took this ancient feast, but now they are the first lambs. They are the new, that they are the chosen people on this night. And we're going to see that the chosen people, the people who thought they were the chosen people, the Egyptians, the greatest nation on earth with their wonderful culture and heritage and all of that, and power, ruling the world really for centuries, this tiny little group of slaves escape from them and become God's chosen people. So from their point of view, and this is of course written from the Jewish point of view or the Israel point of view, Egypt is rejected, Israel is chosen. The firstborn of the Egyptians is rejected, the firstborn of the Israelites is saved. Hence the story, of course not a historical story, of the firstborn of all the Egyptians being killed by an avenging angel. Which of course is impossible to believe. I hope you don't believe it, for heaven's sake. And if you do believe it, just for a moment, imagine yourself as an Egyptian mother living up near the, up in the top of the Nile River, and suddenly your firstborn boy or girl is killed overnight for no reason. You never knew Moses. And God's doing that to show, make a point. Well, if you can believe in a God like that, you might as well leave the room now, because, I mean, it's crazy. So we're not talking about fact there, but we are talking about our perception of choice. So that all gets linked in too, into this old ritual feast. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect. On the 14th day of the month, and they had a lunar month, so the 14th day is always full moon. That's how they worked it. The month didn't start till somebody went from some mountain when they saw the first sign of the new moon. Everybody got their clocks, ticked them over. This is the beginning of month. So it's no surprise that in 14 days there's a full moon. So it's the 14th day of the month. Slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood. That's the key thing. The life. And put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast, unleavened bread. Why it's made without yeast becomes clear two sentences later. This is how you are to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt. So they're ready for a journey. They've got their Adidas, or whatever you've got on, ready to... Sandals on your feet, staff in hand. Now you can see why Jesus told his missionaries that they weren't to have this and weren't to have that, and don't take that, but take a staff and have sandals. You got it? Because they're on a missionary journey to a promised land through a desert, so get going. We say that at the end of Mass every Sunday, don't we? Go, the Mass, that's one of the loveliest words of the Mass. Get out of here, you people. The Mass is ended. And you're not supposed to hang around here enjoying life and tucked into, you can talk for a while, but get out to the mission. Go and tell everyone how much God loves them and bring them back here next Sunday. Stop blushing, but that's what we're supposed to do. So, eat it in haste. That's why it's unleavened bread. Eat it in haste. You haven't got time for it to go, you know, cook and pull it open and put your finger in it and whatever you do to bread. It's the Lord's Passover. On that same night I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn. God is, in their view, rejecting the Egyptian power and all of that, and he's choosing, by contrast, these broken people who've cried in their distress. He's choosing the poor. I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I'm the Lord. I'll pass over you. This is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. And so every full moon of spring, the people would gather and celebrate the Passover. In fact, they didn't for centuries. The feast came quite a lot later. But that's what, at the time the document is written, the feast was an important instituted celebration at the temple, right up to the time of Jesus. So that's what Jesus and his disciples were about to do. In 2 days, the Passover will come. Their mood is that. Their mood is about liberation. Their mood is about journeying. Their mood is about escaping from the trap of Egypt, and the mood is about God leading them somewhere to a promised land. Their mood is about community, because that's where they were formed as a community in the desert. So it's got a lot of beautiful resonances for a Jewish community. And Jesus would have loved to celebrate it. And you always celebrate it with your own family. His family are those who do the will of God. And he chooses the 12 symbolically for the 12 standing stones, the 12 tribes of Egypt. And he gathers them. There may or may not have been others at the Last Supper. There's no proof either way. But we know that the Gospels all focus on the positive statement that the 12 were there. And that's what they want us to know. Because if the 12 are there, everybody's there. The whole world is there. Because 12 represents the universality, the 12 zodiac signs of the heavens. Well, that's what they're looking forward to. Let's see what happens. 26, verse 6. Now, while Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, we haven't heard of him before, but there we are, a woman came to him with an alabaster jar of very costly ointment, and she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. You and I would probably find such a gesture quite horrific, but our culture is different. This is perfume, really. And it's cool, it's poured on the head, yes, and it goes down on the hair and down on the beard, if you've got a beard. If you haven't, good luck to you. And onto your clothing. But it's really a perfume, a refreshing perfume, and it was a welcoming gesture at a big feast, not on any normal occasion. It's also a symbol of the Holy Spirit poured on a king at his coronation or consecration, on a high priest, on a prophet, the pouring of oil. That's why we anoint a child at baptism or an adult. The chrism is the word for the oil. So this woman welcomes Jesus in a very costly way. We're going to see why in a moment, the symbolism, or why it's put in the gospel. This rather strange and unexpected event takes on meaning in the light of Jesus. What happens on the Friday? The disciples saw this and they were angry. And they said, "Why this waste?" And do be careful, I'm talking to myself, and you be careful too. We can get things just out of proportion as the disciples did. They're into poverty. They're into third world need. Good things to be into. But they're so into poverty, they forget love. Not a good idea, would you think? They lose a bit of perspective here, which all of us can do in religious matters if we're not careful. So they do it anyhow. Why this waste? And it is waste from one point of view. This ointment could have been sold for a large sum and the money given to the poor. Can't argue with that. Jesus, aware of this, said to them, "Why are you troubling this woman? She's performed a good service for me. You always have the poor with you. You will not always have me. By pouring this ointment on my body, she has prepared me for burial." The scent of the perfume includes the myrrh, which you put on a body. And as you know, when Jesus died, they didn't have time to anoint him. So it's a kind of a intimation of God's providence caring for Jesus, preparing him for burial in this rather strange way. He continues, "Truly I tell you, wherever this good news is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in remembrance of her." I don't want to pretend to exhaust the meaning of the passage, but I think the key point is this, that Matthew's saying, everyone who hears this gospel, that story, is encouraged by what this unknown woman did to Jesus. To do this for the poor. The very story itself is an inspiration to us not to be mean, and in fact the poor are the least mean people in the world, as all of you know, and when you're poor you're like that too. The poor can throw a party and give you everything they've got, because they haven't got anything anyhow for tomorrow, so you can have the lot. And that's whereas we who have more than we need don't tend to be so generous. So this woman has just poured it over Jesus, and Matthew believes that looking at her do that inspires him and his community to have great largesse in their life, generosity, open-heartedness, and of course, care for the poor. We've just read the passage where Jesus says, "Whatever you do to the least, you do to me." Then one of the 12, who was called Judas Iscariot. Now, we've already been introduced to Judas back in chapter 10, when the apostles, the 12, were named one after the other. And already we were told there, so it's no surprise, even if you hadn't read the gospel before, that Judas is the betrayer. But here's the moment. One of the 12, called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and said, "What will you give me if I betray him to you?" Matthew doesn't say anything about Judas's motivation, so there's no point of us speculating. I mean, you can speculate, but there's really no point. Matthew is not interested in that. He's interested in the terrible fact that Judas did betray Jesus. They paid him, we're told, 30 pieces of silver. Matthew's the only one to mention the amount paid, and whatever the historical data behind that, the point is clear dramatically, because as mentioned there in Exodus chapter 21, 32, 30 pieces of silver was the price for a slave. I'll read the text. "If the ox gores a male or female slave, the owner shall pay to the slave owner 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned." That was the monetary value considered of a slave. So to pay Judas 30 pieces of silver is to say something about Jesus and his expendable nature. From that moment, Judas began to look for an opportunity to betray Jesus. And from this moment in the gospel, we're going to see Jesus more and more isolated. It'll be Judas, then it'll be Peter, then it'll be the rest, till he's totally alone. And yet, at the same time, as I'll show you a little later, Matthew's gospel, it's interesting to compare it to Mark and Luke, though I'm not doing that in this course because I don't want to take sides on which came first and which came second. I'm trying to treat Matthew as though it's the only one, which has defects but also, I think, a positive value. But at any rate, it's true that in Matthew's gospel, "with me, with you, with him," again and again those words come up, even till the very last words of the gospel, "I will be with you all days to the end of the world." There's this sense of being with you, with us, yet rejected and alone. It's quite a tragic, poignant. Can't think of a noun to go with that, so you'll have to guess it for yourself. Counterpoint or something between these two themes. So we're meant to start meditating there on the, you know, for the broken heart of Jesus, really. That one of the ones that he clearly chose, and that's one of the problems if you get into this strange, disincarnate Jesus that can sometimes fill our head. We know Jesus is God, and for most of us, that is so overwhelming that it actually comes in and stops Jesus being a man. Well, he's a man from the shoulders down, but he's got a head full of divine ideas, and so we imagine Jesus knowing the future. Have you ever thought of that? We imagine Jesus, when he first chose Judas, knowing that Judas would betray him. Well, I mean, think about it for a minute, for God's sake. You know, get your brain ticking over. Imagine what a beautiful Jesus he would be. Say you were Judas. And he chose you for the 12, and he already knew you were going to betray him. If he had any decency, he'd say, buzz off, mate. Don't join me, because this, like, it's like a trap. It's like a, God's got everything worked out from the beginning, and we're just slotted into this enormous, impersonal, quite horrific machine. Jesus, I mean, how do I know? But I mean, you've got to know some things. Jesus chose Judas because Judas had leadership potential and character and drive, and he wanted him to be with him when something went sour. And I could start speculating, which I said I wouldn't do, but no point. But let's go back to Jesus' heart. Here is a real break that one of the inner group would betray Jesus. And we're meant to. There's a bit of Judas in me, and there's a bit of Peter, and I might say there's a bit of Mary, the mother of Jesus, too. So I'm not mocking myself. Like, in all of us, there's a bit of the leper, and the, isn't there? We've got all this, all these things playing here, and at times we rock from one to the other. Well, here's Judas, so there's a bit of Judas in all of us. We're quite capable of all this, but it's quite tragic and quite terribly hurting, of course, to Jesus.